Random House Audiobooks presents The Greatest Generation Speaks by Tom Brokaw. Read for you by the author.
The Greatest Generation Speaks. I am a child of the American men and women who grew up in the Great Depression, who came of age in World War II, and then devoted their adult lives to the building of modern America. The remarkable people I wrote about in The Greatest Generation. As I walk the beaches of Normandy on the 40th and 50th anniversaries of D-Day, I first began to realize how they had shaped my life. They were my parents and the parents of my friends, teachers, ministers, physicians, and hometown merchants, the men and women who showed me the way through their own exacting standards of hard work, sacrifice, and personal responsibility. I began to understand how much I owed them. As a son of working-class parents who were deeply rooted in the harsh economic realities of the Depression and the common challenges of the war, I reflected on the good fortune of my generation and the world we inherited. So many of us were the first in our families to attend college and to find that good jobs were plentiful. My generation and those that followed took their place in a world of broader horizons and expanded rights for women and ethnic minorities. It wasn't a perfect world, of course. Far too many of my contemporaries died in Vietnam. But others gave birth to long overdue political and social change. The excesses of youthful rebellion in the 60s and 70s were painful, even destructive in some aspects. But the foundation of the country and its complex culture withstood the onslaught and remained secure. Moreover, my generation and those that followed were not judged by their excesses alone. Indeed, we were given more opportunities and more arenas than our parents had dared to dream. A few years ago, when I thought about my own life and career, somehow it seemed inadequate to thank just my parents, even though their role was irreplaceable and enduring. There were so many people in the fabric of my life growing up that influenced me, teachers and ministers, coaches and merchants, the mothers and fathers of my friends, all the men and women who had experienced so much hardship during the Depression and the war years. And so, when I set out to write The Greatest Generation, I was inspired by these people and by the realization that my world of endless possibilities, even with all of its imperfections, was the work of these remarkable men and women. By writing their stories, I finally had found a way to say thank you. I wanted that book to be my gift to them, an expression of admiration and gratitude for all they had achieved and for the legacy they passed on to future generations. When the book was published, I obviously hoped it would be well received by the people about whom I was writing. As for younger generations, I wasn't sure what to expect. So many of the people I talked with from the World War II generation told me their kids weren't much interested in hearing about the Depression, the war, the sacrifices of the 50s. As for their grandchildren, a generation coming of age with personal computers, digital video, and unparalleled prosperity, stories about the Great Depression and World War II were like grainy black and white images in dusty school books or on late night television. Wooden stories about people's lives during the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s seem like ancient history to a 30-something or a teenager shaping a life in America and the world in the 21st century. And so the response to The Greatest Generation has been not only a pleasant surprise, but also deeply gratifying in ways I could never have predicted. From what people say to me on the street and write to me in letters, some of which appear in this book, The Greatest Generation seems to have generated within many families, communities, schools, even corners of the political arena, a fresh reevaluation of the past and a dialogue about the core values of that time and of the present. Children and grandchildren of the Greatest Generation are telling me they now understand the values reflected in the lives of the people they know from the World War II generation. Values which to many may have seemed a little tiresome in these more permissive times. The older generation's straight-laced code of conduct and discipline. Their frugality and their expectation that once the teenage years were over, the serious grown-up years would begin. My favorite reaction to the Greatest Generation, however, comes to me in unexpected moments. On a ski slope, in an airport, on the streets of New York, in the Pentagon. Men about my age, cops, business executives, military men, construction workers, grab my hand, look me in the eye, and say, "I read your book. Thank you for helping me understand my father." Then they turn and walk away. Any journalist would be flattered to have his or her work become the catalyst for reflection and examination, but I have no illusion about my personal role in all of this. I was merely the reporter, the vehicle for people's stories and the lessons they contained. So many of the veterans said to me of their service during the war, "It was an honor." I feel in turn, it was an honor to have written about the people in that book. But I was totally unprepared for the waves of letters that started to come in as soon as The Greatest Generation was published. Members of The Greatest Generation and their children wrote moving stories to me about heroism and values, friendships, pain, experiences of these times, and of the effect of the book, its memories of the Depression and World War II, had on their lives today. I wrote a book about America, and a lot of America is writing back. The letters, many of them written in firm Palmer penmanship on flowered stationery, gave me new insights into those difficult times. Members of the Greatest Generation, who still believe in the old-fashioned virtues of personal correspondence and personal testimony, could draw on letters that they had written back then, or letters written to them from the front lines, or from families to their loved ones in harm's way in distant places. And so in these pages, you'll hear the voices of the Greatest Generation, their children and grandchildren, in their own language and emotions, many of them sharing unspoken memories and impressions for the first time. You'll also hear how a renewed interest in the World War II years has prompted succeeding generations to re-examine their own lives and values with a fresh perspective. Most of the material in The Greatest Generation Speaks arrived unsolicited. Some of the testimony I encouraged in an effort to include episodes and personalities inadvertently left out of the first book. Even so, I know there remains a rich repository of other memories. One of the enduring and fundamental lessons of history, too often ignored, is that if we ignore the past, we cannot adequately prepare for the future. As we listen to these quiet voices of a generation that speak to us of duty and honor, sacrifice and accomplishment, I hope that more of their stories will be preserved and cherished as reminders of all that we owe them and all that we can learn from them. Now, let's hear some war stories. Recently, I read again Eric Maria Remarque's classic war novel, All Quiet on the Western Front. It is a German soldier's reflection on the terror, cruelty, and absurdity of combat during World War I, yet the themes perfectly match what American veterans wrote in their personal accounts of life at the front during World War II. Those memoirs, many of them self-published or simply bound manuscripts, add to the rich body of literature from World War II. The best of that literature, the works of James Jones, Norman Mailer, Kurt Vonnegut, Joseph Heller, and Paul Fussell, for example, is well known. The homespun books will likely never be read outside the author's immediate family. Still, the memoirs of infantrymen, flyers, sailors, and chaplains get at the essential truths of war in their own memorable and deeply personal fashion. They also remind us that for these men in their late teens and early 20s, the lessons of death, fate, futility, and pure, unalloyed high-risk adventure were never to be matched in their own other experiences. Whenever an American flyer was down during the NATO bombing raids on Serbia, he was quickly located and picked up by elite search and rescue units utilizing the latest high-technology communication systems, which made it possible for the operation to be monitored thousands of miles away in the Pentagon. In contrast, consider the Americans who were trapped by the Japanese on Corregidor in the Philippines at the outset of World War II. One of them was Clarence M. Graham, now 80 years old, and living on a small landholding in Oregon. He was taken prisoner at the beginning of May 1942 and shipped off to Japan to work in a coal mine across the bay from a city called Nagasaki. For the next 3.5 years, he worked in the mine, and then one day in the summer of 1945, he was witness to a historic event. This is what he wrote to me. I am just one of many who were engaged in that war. I was stationed in the Philippines when it started and in an anti-aircraft battery. We were on the Bataan Peninsula. We were engaged in jungle fighting to the bitter end of that battle. Our battery escaped on the last night and made it back to the island of Corregidor. There we continued the defense until on May 9, 1942, Corregidor was captured. Nearly all of us who had survived to that point were undernourished and wounded in one way or another, and most were wounded more than once. We were taken prisoners by the Japanese and were used as slaves, tortured in various ways, and maintained on starvation rations. Many were murdered. Many died of diseases and starvation. During the last 3.5 years as a POW, I worked in a condemned lateral of the Fuquoqua coal mine near the city of Omuta. While there, I was an eyewitness to the explosion of the atomic bomb that was dropped on the city of Nagasaki just west and across the bay from us. In a telephone interview, Graham took us back to the 1940s and his life in the coal mine. It was very hot work and very deep. The air was quite bad in there. The dust was terrible because it was soft bituminous coal, and it filled the air and we had to breathe it. You had to keep your wits about you to stay alive because one false move and your life was nothing in that country. They'd kill you in an instant if you disobeyed. In the mines, we had a shift that contained three types of work. There would be 3 or 4 men shoveling, 3 or 4 picking the coal off the coal face, and the others would be picking up layers of slate and building pyramids of rock that held up the ceiling. We took just one day at a time. I know that I kept saying, I've got to keep my mind clear and look for something good. Like, for one thing, I had a battery light that didn't leak on me and get acid on my skin. Little things you'd keep yourself tantalized with, like, maybe soon you'll get a chance to get a break or something. I had a little belt on my waist, and all we wore was a loincloth. Sometimes I got to coughing so bad that I would take off my whole wardrobe and wrap it around my face so I could breathe. You could see only eyeballs and teeth when you looked at someone because they were covered with black coal. We carried a cigar box with rice in it. That would be our ration for a 12-hour shift. Sometimes the coal was so heavy, we couldn't find our boxes. When you're a prisoner in those conditions, you don't care who it is, what his name is, who's next to you. You don't need a name. You have so little that you have to say that you don't carry on a conversation. You're like oxen. We always wondered how the Allies were doing. Fellows made up rumors, but we knew nothing. I kept thinking, well, if the good Lord wanted me to get through this, I would make it. If he didn't, I wouldn't. I kept my faith pretty high because so many people just gave up. And you couldn't. You had to have inner drive or you'd just die. We had just come in off a long, hard shift, and they were getting very brutal because of the bombing on Hiroshima. And they were stirred up like hornets and taking it out on the Americans in the worst way. They said after Hiroshima, they wouldn't give us any food, and that we would have to work until the emperor decided that we didn't have to work anymore. We came out of the mine, and it was daylight, and they didn't give us any breakfast. They told us to be quiet, or we'd be killed. And then we had to go into our barracks, no talking. That's when there was this air raid siren, and we were ordered out to the trenches built in the camp between the barracks. They weren't trying to protect us from the bombing. They needed our slave labor to get the coal to their war machines. No Japanese would go into the coal mines. We went into the trenches and heard some planes, but never saw them. Then they blew the all clear. But just as we were coming out, I heard another plane, and I looked up and saw an opening in the clouds, and I saw a B-29. I thought at the time, why don't they bomb? What are they joyriding for? And then we saw a brilliant flash. There's no way to describe the brightness. You couldn't tell where the flash came from. Just brilliant brightness. Then seconds later, there was a small tremor on the ground. You could feel the ground shaking. Then there was a strong wind that came from the west, which is the direction of Nagasaki across the bay. And following that wind, there was a hot, hot wind, terribly hot, hotter than direct sun on your face. Then there was a lull and a terrific wind, almost a typhoon wind from the west, which was the air rushing back to the bomb center after the heat had gone up. The wind was so strong, it toppled over some of our weak prisoners, just flattened them. That's when we saw this huge orange dome to the west, and we were wondering what in the world it was. And then, out of it, there was an opening, and all the clouds disappeared, and you could see the bright blue sky. And then this column of white smoke came up just like a tornado, and we were standing there watching, and the Japanese are all quiet. And then all of a sudden, it starts to mushroom toward the top. The funny thing about it all was that I never heard it. It must have been so loud that my ears were not able to pick it up. We were in a state of shock, not knowing anything about the atomic bomb. I remember someone saying, "Wow, what a blast." Then someone else said, "They must have hit a big ammunition dump." Then after that, we were ordered back to the barracks. They, the guards, were mean, but not as mean as after Hiroshima. Here, they were just in a state of shock. Graham didn't wait for a liberation force after those years of misery, torture, and animal-like survival. A few days later, he slipped through the fence, stole a bicycle, and made his way to the nearby city of Omuta to hook up with Allied forces. He was flown out of Japan on a C-47, and as it gained altitude, he looked down to see a rainbow, a perfect circle against the deep blue waters of the China Sea. As he watched, a second rainbow formed around the first one. Graham, a lump in his throat, said to the pilot, "Do you see that?" The pilot responded, "Yes, it must be for you." Graham closed his eyes and offered a silent prayer to God. He was headed home. An established figure in American life is John Whitehead, a former senior partner at the Wall Street firm of Goldman Sachs and a deputy secretary of state in the administration of George Bush, who was the last of the World War II veterans to become president. Upon returning to New York following his State Department service, Whitehead became chairman of the International Rescue Committee, a private organization working tirelessly on the problems of refugees from strife around the world. I asked him to reflect on his war years. Just as everyone remembers where they were when President Kennedy was shot, so too people in my generation remember where they were when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. It was Sunday, December 7th, 1941, at 2 p.m., and I was manning the checkout desk at the Haverford College Library, working off the hours of one of my various work scholarships. The attack was big news, and I knew my life would never be the same. Two of my classmates, Paul Cope and Chris Cadbury, proposed that we drive down to Washington that night and hear the president declare war. It was a little silly because, of course, we had no way to get into the Capitol where the speech was to take place. Nevertheless, off we went in Chris's ancient jalopy and stood the next day on the Capitol steps and listened to the famous "Date Which Will Live in Infamy" speech. We felt very much part of it, and so we were. It was to be a war that involved everyone. There were a few Haverford students, it being a Quaker college, who were conscientious objectors and refused to register. Others, who registered but then declared themselves conscientious objectors, were, if they could prove a lifetime belief in pacifism, assigned to alternative service, which meant work on a farm or driving an ambulance or some similar non-military work. The boards did a pretty good job in separating the suddenly opportunistic pacifists from those with lifetime, deeply held religious beliefs. I had half a dozen Quaker classmates who fell into this category. The rest of us were subject to be drafted at any time, and most of us looked around for an alternative military program that would permit us to graduate before being called up. My friend and classmate, Bob McCrate, and I discovered just such a program. It was a Navy Supply Corps program which, if we qualified, would allow us to graduate, then commission us as ensigns in the Navy, and then send us for 90 days to Harvard Business School, which had been taken over for the duration by the Navy to learn Navy accounting, and then send us off to sea. I was called to active duty in June of 1943, assigned temporarily to the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and immediately assigned as commanding officer of the 20th Street Pier in South Brooklyn while awaiting the next class at the Harvard Business School. Here I was exposed, maybe for the first time, to being way over my head. Come to think of it, life for me has been a series of over-my-head experiences from which I had to struggle my way out. As a junior officer assigned to the USS Thomas Jefferson, Whitehead lived well and relished his position as the ship supply officer. That often involved borrowing one of the new landing craft boats so he could motor over to other ships and trade for the supplies he needed. He quickly became a deft helmsman, and someone was watching. His commanding officer called him to a private meeting in the captain's quarters. Whitehead's account of the meeting follows. "I want to assign you to some extra duty," the commanding officer said. "Yes, sir." "Ensign R.L. Jones, one of my boat officers, has become ill and is going to be leaving the ship. And if you're willing and able, I'd like you to replace him temporarily for the next several weeks." "Yes, sir." "I've been watching you go back and forth to the dock. You've become pretty good at handling an LCVP, landing craft, vehicle, and personnel boat." "Yes, sir." Now, my normal duties on the ship had to do with paying the crew, paying other bills, and helping procure whatever supplies the ship needed to operate. My so-called battle station was up on the signal bridge, the very top of the ship, where, with others, I was to identify incoming airplanes as friend or foe. Now, while these duties had their risks, enemy bombings, kamikaze planes, torpedoes, and so on, they were not exactly hand-to-hand combat. What the captain was asking me to do was to be a boat officer in the upcoming invasion, which meant being in charge of a group of four or five LCVPs, each carrying 20 Army or Marine infantry men from our mothership to an enemy beach, usually at the beginning of an invasion. This was another kettle of fish. But what could I do? I couldn't say no. And so I said yes. The captain stood up, shook my hand, wished me luck, and that was that. I kind of floated back to my cabin, both proud and scared. As soon as we reached Portsmouth, the ship was put under tight security. In Navy lingo, the ship was sealed. No arrivals or departures. No liberty. No mail. Lots of briefings, and for me, lots to learn. Lots of poring over maps and looking at photographs of the shoreline. Lots of clambering up into an LCVP on its davits on the deck to be sure I knew every inch of it. We were to land 2,000 soldiers from the 29th Division on Dog Red Beach in the Omaha sector of the beaches of Normandy. Finally, on June 4th, the word came to go in spite of the weather. It was a false alarm. The weather was too bad, and partway across the channel, we were ordered to turn around and come back to Portsmouth. It was a bit of a letdown. 24 hours later, however, late in the afternoon of June 5th, we left again, and this was the real thing. The slower ships went first, and the fastest ships last, so we could all arrive off the beach at the same time. There were hundreds of ships. It was still stormy, raining really hard, and the sea was choppy. The crossing was uneventful, no submarines. When we were loaded, my five LCBPs found each other, formed a circle like a cat chasing its tail, and waited for other boats to form up. It was pitch dark, drizzling, and cold, and the air was dark with diesel fumes. The sea was choppy, and within a few minutes, everyone was seasick. Picture 20 men, all standing packed into a 24-foot flat-bottom boat for 4 hours, heavily laden with rifles and packs, all seasick. It was pretty miserable. It was very noisy. The sound of the engines of all the boats made it impossible to shout back and forth from boat to boat, and we used walkie-talkies to communicate. Somehow, our five boats kept together. By about 4 o'clock, the first faint light of dawn began to appear, and it was easier to identify the other boats. Lost boats began to find their mates. Before long, we began to hear the deep-throated explosions of 16-inch shells fired at the beach from battleships farther out at sea. And then the drone of planes overhead, carrying paratroopers from the 82nd and 101st Airborne Divisions to land behind the beach. It was very comforting to see that some things seemed to be working as they were supposed to. At about 800 yards, we were released to make the final run into the beach on our own. Our five little boats were still together and seemed ready to go. It was light enough now for them to see hand signs and for me to see my watch. It was 6:05, and I waved them on in. When we got within about 100 yards of the beach, we saw there was ahead of us a solid phalanx of steel obstacles designed to keep LCBPs from landing. We had prepared for these obstacles, which were called Element C, but not for such a solid alignment in front of us. I signaled our boats to come to a dead stop. If we had continued on to Dog Red Beach straight ahead, we all would have been hung up on those obstacles in water too deep to debark the troops. I signaled our five boats to turn sharp left parallel to the beach. After about 100 yards, we found an opening and headed for the beach again. Our boats were now a little mixed up with the boats designated to land where we were now heading, but the beach was wide enough for all of us. It was about this time that the first German mortar shell exploded right at the waterline of the beach that we had been heading for. But we were now about to hit the beach next door and had no time to worry about mortars. The impact of the boats hitting the ground was supposed to be enough to jar loose the boat ramps, which would fall forward in the water, letting the soldiers debark. It worked for everyone else but our boat. Our ramp stayed closed. I left my post in back of the coxswain and went forward to help the bowman loosen the ramp. After a few blows from the hammer, our ramp came down too and our soldiers debarked. I glanced at the other boats in our wave and saw that they were ready to withdraw. Our job now was to get off the beach as quickly as possible to get out of the way of the second wave, which was to land directly behind us. We raised our ramps and retreated without any serious problems. We also realized that our job with the soldiers we had landed was completed, but that theirs was only beginning, and that they had days and weeks and months ahead before their job was over. In the meantime, we were returning to the Jefferson for a good hot shower and a hot brunch served for the officers in the wardroom by black stewards' mates. Rather incongruous for a group of men who had just landed on the first wave at Normandy. The soldiers were the real heroes. There was one moment of D-Day which, rather strangely, remains more vivid in my mind than anything else. It was a quiet moment, a moment of peace and introspection after a very long day of noise and fear, of chaos and seasickness, of little acts of courage, and of death. It was about 3 o'clock, and we had made our second landing of the day and would soon be starting again the 2-hour trip back to the Thomas Jefferson. The beach was now secure. My 5 little boats had all made it in without serious problems, and we were actually a little ahead of schedule. The ship's crew had only 2 casualties from the landing. The Army lieutenant from my boat was now busy trying to get ashore a large machine gun, and for the first time since 2 a.m., I had a free moment. I clambered off the boat, we were stuck on a little shoal in about 2 feet of water, and walked a few yards up the beach. I took a few deep breaths and looked around me. The dead and wounded had been moved up to the first dune and were being cared for. Equipment, guns and food and ammunition was being unloaded along with more troops. As far as I could see, in both directions, LCVPs were landing, unloading, and withdrawing. And I realized that what I could see was less than 5% of the landing beaches. It wasn't orderly, but it wasn't chaos either. I got the sense that it was going to work, that what had looked like such a disaster only a few hours earlier was beginning to look like it had a chance. I felt thankful, of course, that I seemed to have survived the worst part. I took a few deep breaths and felt suddenly elated, proud to have even a tiny part in what was maybe the biggest battle of all history. At that moment, soaked to the skin, seasick, dead tired, cold, still scared, I would not have wanted to be anywhere else. Not all war stories are about combat, heroism, life and death. Raymond Dom described his final, never-to-be-forgotten days as a combat photographer and the rescue of priceless artifacts from the personal collection of Ludwig von Beethoven. I was 19 in 1942 when I enlisted in the U.S. Army Signal Corps. I served in the Army as a motion picture combat cameraman following a semester study at the University of Southern California's Department of Cinema. I was armed with a .45 revolver, and it was my job to shoot the shooters with a government-issued 12-pound, 35-millimeter IMO movie camera. We were assigned to fighting units in the European Theater of Operations, mainly the ground forces of infantry divisions. In one armored attack at about the time of the Battle of the Bulge, I was wounded as 300 German prisoners of war were rounded up at the end of a long tank battle. I got in the way of German artillery as I walked alongside our Sherman tanks and was whacked by an .88 shell that pierced my helmet as I knelt to reload my camera. I returned to combat 2 days later along with scores of GIs also hit in that German barrage. There is nothing like a close call on a battlefield to make the morning more beautiful, to make the green fields more fragrant, and to make life seem like a worthwhile journey. As the Allied armies had penetrated deeper into Germany and the German high command could see that the end of the war was near, Field Marshal Hermann Göring, commander of the German Luftwaffe, who was infamous for his looting of Europe's artistic treasures, dispatched orders to all German museums to disperse their collections so that they would not be looted and pillaged by the invading armies. One of these historical sites was the Beethoven House in Bonn. This was the birthplace, the home of the composer, and had been converted into a museum. It was known that the museum collection included 3 pianos owned by Beethoven, several musical instruments, and oil portraits important to him in his life, including Joseph Haydn, Mozart, Schubert, and others. Just months before, German transport trucks had appeared at the museum, where the treasures were quickly loaded, and the convoy, headed by Dr. Wildemann, the curator, traveled to various rural sites in Rhineland province. We took back roads. It would be a long journey to avoid the major highways that were littered with destroyed tanks and abandoned equipment left by the Germans. And what we dreaded most were the landmines put in place by the retreating enemy. I thought to myself that if this journey had taken place only a few days earlier, we might have taken enemy fire. As we drove through small villages, it was obvious that some Germans were afraid to come out of their houses. They were not sure the war had ended, but some villages had white cloths of surrender hanging from windows or on poles. The children were the bravest, coming out of their homes into the street, pointing handmade toy guns at us, for most of the populace in these rural regions refused to believe their country had actually capitulated. I caught these scenes in my camera's viewfinder as we approached each side on Wildemann's list of hiding places for the museum's treasures. I would jump out of the truck's cab as doors were hesitantly opened, and I could see faces of fear, the occupants not sure what fate awaited them, until Wildemann smiled reassuringly, speaking quickly, as my camera whirred, harmlessly. Then out they would come, the crates, the trunks, and from Hamburg Castle, the three pianos that had been hidden in the castle's dungeon. Finally, we were led to the Siegen salt mines, where the precious artworks and boxes of musical manuscripts had been stored because the salt deposits absorbed the moisture from the air, leaving temperatures and humidity virtually constant. Now, at the end of our quest, Dr. Wildemann asked me to hand-carry a huge bundle of autographed music manuscripts, the originals, and so priceless. The manuscripts for the piano sonatas were present, including the Moonlight Sonata, and scores of the Pastoral and Ninth Symphonies. We finally reached Bonn, which was like a ghost town with blocks and blocks of incendiary ruins. Dr. Wildemann signaled for us to turn down a street with a sign which read, Beethoven Haus Gosse. We came to a stop before a large boarded-up portal. The first thing I noticed were German words. Eintritt verboten Museum. Entry forbidden, museum. In filming inside and outside the museum, I was shown by the caretaker the room upstairs where Beethoven was born in 1770. One question we all asked ourselves, which had to be answered, how was it possible that this little 200-year-old tinderbox building had survived the severe and prolonged incendiary bombings? The German caretaker's story was one of the most amazing to come out of the war. Each night, he told us, translated by Dr. Wildemann, that as the incendiary bombs began to fall, he would crawl up to the roof of the house with a garden hose turned on with as much pressure as it would afford, and he would spray, douse the walls and roof all night long until the bombing ceased to keep the wood and plaster as wet as possible for the structure to survive another night. What a day it had been. A unique and gratifying experience for us all, and in a way I felt I had contributed somehow to the making of peace in Europe. I guess it has to be my best-remembered story, and one not about the fighting, but about the mutual respect for one of mankind's most admirable accomplishments, great music. As I look back to that day in Bonn, it had provided a moment of sanity in the hectic demise of the Third Reich. The experience proved that the only glory of war is in the hope of cooperation between the enemies afterward. At Beethoven House, conquerors and the conquered had joined hands to preserve mankind's priceless heritage and culture. Veronica Mackey Hulick of Fort Pierce, Florida, became a Navy wave during World War II and before long found herself assigned to a secret project. At first, she didn't know what she was working on, but later she discovered it was a critical part of the Allied success. I was 20 years old when I joined the Navy Waves in January 1943. After boot camp, I was sent with a contingent to Dayton, Ohio. We were assigned to a building across from the National Cash Register Company, NCR. We sat at a long table with a soldering iron, long threads of solder, and inch-long wires of red, yellow, green, and blue. We were given a small wheel and a graph to follow. We soldered the little wires inside the wheel according to the graph. The wheel was then covered with graphite. Plastics had not been invented as yet. I decided that I must not have passed the aptitude test. This had to be the dumbest job in the Navy. However, I was surrounded by many bright young women, many of whom, like me, were former telephone operators. One day, my mother called to say a Navy officer was going all around my hometown, Wilmington, Delaware, asking questions about me. He went to my teachers, friends, employers, and neighbors. I didn't know what was going on, but I began to feel important. We worked a swing shift and had one day off a week. The third week, we got 2 days off. It took 3 months to get a Saturday and Sunday off. We were constantly monitored by WAVE officers and had many sessions on security about our work. This went on from April till October. I went on duty one day and saw something huge on a flat car near our building. It was covered with a gray shroud. I said to myself, I wonder what that is. I know now it was the housing for the computer that was being built. NCR built the housing, the switches and the wiring, and we women wired the rotor wheels. That day, we were told we were being transferred to Washington, D.C. We were assigned to barracks across the street from the Naval Communications Annex at Nebraska and Massachusetts Avenue. When we went on duty, we had to show our picture and number ID to two armed Marines at the gates and a Navy man at our building. The first day on duty, we were taken into a chapel, and a Navy officer stood in the pulpit and told us if we talked about what we were on at this station, we would be shot. About 500 women ran these 120 computers on the swing shift. It was constant for the next 2.5 years. We never breached security. We'd gotten the message loud and clear. The computer was nicknamed the bomb because of the noise it made while running. The word computer was not in the vocabulary at that time. Also missing in those times was air conditioning. The oppressive heat of the D.C. summers was unbelievable, but we were young and full of patriotism. We lived in two-story barracks, 50 girls on each floor. We had a bunk, a locker, and community showers. We all got along, worked hard, and had fun on our days off. When we got a printout from the computer, we couldn't read it. We tore it off quickly, ran to a door at the end of the room, knocked, and a hand came out and took it, I presume, to a decoding room. We had 120 computers, and when we rev them up, we got a trillion combinations. Hitler once sent a message to a general. We intercepted and broke it before it reached the general's hands. When the war was over and we were being discharged, we were taken individually into an officer and told to put one hand on the Bible and take an oath that we would never talk about our work. We had a form for future employers stating they were not to ask us about our activities during World War II. 500 women went home, got on with their lives, and never said a word. In 1977, President Carter declassified a lot of World War II material, and a couple of books were written about the bomb. The Navy never informed any of these women that the oath was lifted. My parents died never knowing what I did in the service. In 1994, a reunion was held in Dayton, Ohio. About 80 women showed up. A Navy historian spoke to us and told us we were responsible for the sinking of between 750 and 800 German U-boats, that we shortened the war by 1 and possibly 2 years and had saved countless lives. It was a wonderful moment. It was great to be able to tell my children and grandchildren of my work during World War II. But I wept for those who had passed away and never revealed their contribution to the war effort. You are right. It was a different time in our history. We were patriotic, disciplined, caring, and just so thrilled to know we were doing something special to help end the war. We never sought recognition. I always thought of us as the unsung heroines of World War II. Bonds. There was never a time in American life when so many people were involved in so many ways in a shared cause. It was impossible not to be affected in some fashion by the war effort, however far you may have been from the front lines. In that common experience, old ties were strengthened and new ones were formed to last a lifetime, personal bonds. Whatever else may have happened later, World War II was a shared passage of trial and terror, triumph and loss, laughter and reflection. There was never anything quite like it again. The relationships they formed have been a continuing and reaffirming link to that unique time. The father of my friend and colleague Tim Russert of Meet the Press is a World War II veteran, a B-24 crewman in the 8th Air Force. Tim Russert Sr., Big Russ we call him, has two families, his son and three daughters, and his buddies at the South Buffalo, New York American Legion Post 721, working-class men who are joined forever by their adventures in what so many of that generation call simply the war. In The Greatest Generation, I wrote about the Dumbos, the dinner and bridge meeting of my parents-in-law and their friends from World War II. It began when the wives formed a mutual support group, although they would never have called it that, to fill the long days while their men were in harm's way in distant places. After the war, when the men came home, the group became a long-running gathering of close friends. It turns out there were an untold number of other gatherings across the land, structured in much the same way. Herb Carner of Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, wrote to my wife's aunt and uncle, Lois and Don Gatchell in Tulsa, to describe his hometown bridge club, which reminds him of the Dumbos. Instead of four couples, our group consisted of six couples. We have no specific name, but are generally known as the Bridge Club. Our origin was the same, all married couples with men in service overseas, women at home raising family and keeping things rolling. When men returned, we began a rotational meeting at each home for a home-cooked meal with the hostess furnishing the meat and others bringing vegetables, salads, and desserts, each contributing their favorite dish. Before the meal, we had a round of drinks. Just one. Remember, liquor was expensive in those days when cash was short. To this day, my wife Ruth's favorite drink is a whiskey sour. Following the meal, we played bridge. We had a custom that when someone went down, the players who lost would put a penny in a pot. The accumulated pot went to the player who drew a 10-high hand. It seems improbable, but at one time the pot got as high as $17. Overzealous bidding, perhaps. Who are we? I am the oldest by a few months. I will be 84 in June. The youngest is 77. Two were in the Air Corps, one a B-17 pilot, and me, an aviation ordnance officer. Two were Navy, both serving aboard ships. Two were Army, one enlisted, one officer. Sorry, no Marines. But I do have a close tie to the Marines, which is another story. Two of us, of which I am one, also saw combat in Korea, which also is another story. Today, the group is still together. However, about 3 years ago, we stopped playing bridge because one of the group died. Heart attack. But those of us who can still get around get together once a month. No longer do the ladies cook. We meet at a local restaurant selected by the host. We still have one drink. We visit about children, grandchildren, and great-grandkids, politics and sports, and we share the latest jokes. When we returned from service, we all resumed our lives. My wife and I bought a house as she had been living with her parents. Several of us completed our education and resumed careers in manufacturing, engineering, insurance, retail. I went into the newspaper business after doing other things. During all this time, there have been no divorces among the lot of us. Sadly, this is not true of our offspring. As a group, we have 13 children. Three of us have three, including my wife and me. One has two kids, and two have one each. Our collective offspring have done well. Several divorces, but professionally, they include doctors and a variety of other professions and businesses. They have kept out of trouble, and so far, our grandchildren are the kind you brag about. We have 10 grandchildren and 3 great-grands. Most of us, at one time or another, have attended a reunion of our old outfit. For the most part, it's fun, but also depressing. Several years ago, Ruth and I attended a reunion of the survivors of the Iwo Jima landing, my tie to the Marines, and when we walked into the hotel lobby, she exclaimed, "My goodness, there's nobody here but a bunch of old, gray-haired men." Today, I am in relatively good health, about 10 pounds over my fighting weight, active in the community and the Broken Arrow Historical Society. I belong to Downtown Tulsa Kiwanis Club, member for 38 years, and enjoy woodworking, gardening, and photography on a lesser scale than previously. But I am proudest that on January 1st, my wife and I have been married 61 years. Please pardon this intrusion into your life, but I was so moved, many times to tears, when reading Brokaw's book, that I felt you would understand my impulse to share our experience as a similar Dumbo group. At least I feel better for having written. I also wrote about the Romeo Club, a band of veterans who had grown up in the poor Irish-American neighborhoods of Cambridge, Massachusetts, just around the corner from Harvard Yard. Romeo stands for Retired Old Men Eating Out. The eternal leprechauns of the Cambridge Romeo Club heard from other informal chapters and even had inquiries about whether there was an application process to start a local Romeo Club. Every generation has a collective memory, a shared experience, but the men and women who went through the Great Depression and World War II were unique in that the events of their lifetime were so inclusive. Children of the 60s may identify with Woodstock or the Chicago 7, with sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But what about the others who went to Vietnam or voted for Richard Nixon? For that generation, the memory screen is divided. But for the greatest generation, it is a family portrait. Those bonds take many forms, some of them haunting, painful. Gregory Kirshner of Bethel Park, Pennsylvania, wrote to share a story he's carried with him since the war and to ask for help. Kirshner served as a medic with the 76th Infantry Division and has tried for more than 50 years to locate the wife of a soldier he treated on the battlefield. After the war, Kirshner worked for the Postal Service for 36 years and raised 10 children, 9 of whom are college graduates. He writes, "I consider myself very fortunate to have survived. When an infantry company went into combat, there were 3 medics such as me assigned to it. I outlived the first 2 men assigned with me to Company I, 417th Infantry Regiment, 76th Infantry Division. I also outlived 8 replacement medics. When I was promoted, another man took my place. He was killed the following morning. I have tried without success for over 50 years to locate the family of a man I treated on the battlefield. This man, one of 5 who lost all or part of a leg in a minefield, lost a leg at the hips. As I treated him, he said to me, 'My God, what will my wife say?' There he was, almost blown in half, and he was thinking of her, not himself. This all happened at night during a rainfall. I could not see then that the end of his nose was blown off. I have always wanted to let his wife know that he was thinking of her. This desire has been renewed when I see the scope of the research you had to do. His name was Glenn Jones. All I know is that he lived in one of the southern states. 3 days before, Glenn had received a letter from his wife stating that she was about to enter the hospital for their first child. He said, 'I hope she will be okay.' He died in an ambulance on his way to a field hospital. With the invaluable help of the Veterans Administration, we found Sergeant Jones' widow, Virginia, living in a rural area of western North Carolina. She moved there from Winston-Salem to be with her parents and have her child after Jones was killed. She never remarried. Virginia was surprised to hear of Kirchner's letter since she's never met anyone who served with her husband. She agreed to speak with him on the telephone but asked that he not include any gory details, explaining that after 54 years, the hurt is still there. I arranged for Kirchner to call on an autumn Sunday afternoon and they talked for an hour. He said he was thrilled to have lived so long to finally have found her. Kirchner told her he was not only her husband's medic, but also his friend. And he recalled when they were on the move and received mail from home, Kirchner said, 'We were reading our letters and Glenn said, well, by now my wife should be entering the hospital for our first baby.' He also told her how her husband repeatedly worried about her welfare as he was being treated for his fatal wounds. As for Virginia, she said their conversation was almost like getting a message from Glenn. She was particularly pleased because her grandson, who is a history buff, will now be able to read something about a grandfather he never knew. Virginia said that when her husband was killed, they'd been married 10 months and 10 days, and Glenn Jr. arrived 2 months later. She said her husband would be proud to know that he had a son carrying his name, adding that at first she found it difficult to call her son Glenn, but after a while she was glad she had named him for his father. Glenn Jr., 54, is an engineer with the International Paper Company in Wilmington, North Carolina. He was raised by his mother, his grandparents, and uncles. A few years ago, Virginia gave him a shadow box that contained his father's medals from the war. Kirchner told Virginia another friend of Glenn's, Andrew Pastrick of Ohio, was also wounded at the same time and returned home alive, but with part of his leg missing. He said he would put them in touch as well. 54 years after a terrible night in the dark and rain of the Battle of the Bulge, when Sergeant Glenn Jones was mortally wounded, his wife now knows his final thoughts were of her. W.E. Bilderbach of Fort Worth, Texas, had a similar experience, but with a dramatic variation. Bilderbach, a Texas businessman, wrote about a letter taken from a dead Japanese soldier at Iwo Jima. Reading a translation of the letter 50 years later helped change his views about the Japanese. He writes, "During World War II, I was a first lieutenant in anti-aircraft artillery. I made the invasion of Iwo Jima with the Marine Corps. One night at Iwo Jima, a lot of Japanese soldiers were killed. The next morning, one of my sergeants told me he had taken a letter from one of the dead soldiers and asked if I would like to have it. I said yes, I would. 50 years later, on a trip to Maui, I had the letter translated by a young woman at the Kapalua Bay Hotel. When my wife read me the letter, I cried. It could have been written to me by my own wife. I detested the Japanese at the time the letter was written because I had been taken away from my new bride and a promising career. But this letter made me realize that the dead soldier didn't want to be in Iwo Jima either. The young woman who translated the letter was so emotional, she cried. She asked if I would mind if she kept the letter and tried to locate the Japanese wife. A year later, the widow was found and presented with the letter. The following is the letter to Mr. Bilderbach from the Japanese soldier's wife, Yoshi Sakuma. I would like to express my sincere appreciation for all your and Ms. Iji's recent efforts on my behalf. I received the letter of memento written to my late husband in the presence of the mayor of Funahiki Town and the officials of the Fukushima Prefectural Government and Funahiki Town. Though Mr. William Bilderbach does not understand Japanese, he kept the letter which was entrusted to him during the Second World War over 50 years ago. I truly feel that this letter reminds us that all the people living on the earth can be united as one, despite the conflicts we have endured through history. I read the letter again and again, and I felt that my late husband had finally come back to us after 51 years. I was flooded with 1,000 emotions and tears. As soon as I received the letter, I visited his grave to tell him of this matter. Before the war, I had lived with my late husband and 2 daughters happily in the vicinity of the Joban coal mine. However, he was called into the army and fell in battle on Iwo Jima Island. I was at my wit's end, and I came back to my parents' home with my daughters. However, my youngest daughter passed away due to illness shortly thereafter. I started work as a laborer, but we earned a precarious living. I remarried and lived with my second husband and my daughter's family and my 2 granddaughters for a while, and now my 2 granddaughters have married, and I am blessed with 4 great-grandchildren. I am 80 years old now. We live happily on a small old-age pension provided by the National Pension System of Japan. I believe that your and Yuriki Igi's thoughtfulness, which transcends national boundaries, will contribute to building stronger ties of friendship, and this will be passed down for posterity from generation to generation. World War II was a great equalizer. Poor kids and sons of privilege were side by side in the foxhole or bomber cockpit. Texas cowboys and street-smart toughs from Brooklyn depended on each other to stay alive. Harvard graduates learned from high school dropouts. George Chungus of Weston, Massachusetts, shared a particularly poignant story about the bonds between his father and a surgeon he knew during the Normandy invasion. He writes, "My father died at the age of 44 in 1963, but I can still remember the stories that he told regarding his wartime experiences in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and, of course, D-Day. He was a medic who landed sometime on that first day, and I can only imagine the horror and carnage that he witnessed. As I reflect upon his stories, he never spoke of the horrors of the war. Instead, he talked incessantly about the lasting friendships he developed, and many of the photographs in my possession today reveal wartime camaraderie, time spent with the children and other residents of any particular town or village in which his company happened to be at any given time, and the like. In fact, I am in possession of a photo taken by a Utah Beach cafe owner and his wife that later became part of a Normandy postcard depicting my father and a friend relaxing on Utah Beach shortly after the invasion. The cafe owner billed them as the first two Americans to land on Utah Beach on D-Day. Clearly, this was somewhat of an exaggeration, but not by much. I had the opportunity to visit this family in 1972 and sat in their cafe while the owner and his wife tried to communicate their feelings about what my father and the American soldiers in general meant to them. I look very much like my father, and I can still remember so vividly the cafe owner, Felix, pointing to the original photo of my father and his friend that was hanging on the wall of the cafe, and then pointing to me, with tears streaming down his face. I will close with a story that will stay with me forever and reinforces much of what you present in your book about this incredible generation. My father learned in early 1961 that one Dr. Ballantyne was senior neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital. He had always marveled at Dr. Ballantyne's incredible battlefield neurosurgical skills as he had served in Dr. Ballantyne's unit and witnessed field surgical miracles too numerous to recount. My father owned and operated a dairy products processing business. One day, he took it upon himself to drive into Boston to deliver several tubs of specialty Greek cheeses to Dr. Ballantyne and renew his acquaintance. My father was taken back by Dr. Ballantyne's surprise and shock that someone would actually do that, as he simply wanted to express his admiration for what he had seen Dr. Ballantyne do under some incredible conditions in Normandy. 2 years later, my father was stricken with a triple brain aneurysm and requested that Dr. Ballantyne perform the operation. The operation was a success, but his heart gave out and he died shortly thereafter. Dr. Ballantyne's team of 8 medical specialists operated for 10 hours. When the uninsured portion of the bill arrived at our house, some $25,000 in 1963, it was marked paid in full with a warm, personal note to the family from Dr. Ballantyne, remarking, among other things, on the impact on him of the surprise visit by my father 2 years earlier.